KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, don't you understand? I'm a paleo nerd.
I'm hey, Ray.
Hey, Dave. So good to see you, man.
Yes, we are in the winter of this year, whatever year it happens to be.
Yeah, whatever year this is. But yeah, we're in the winter of our fish content. See what I did there?
Uh-huh. And how was your winter in Ketchikan so far? We're a week from Christmas or that strange holiday near the equinox.
Well, it's approaching zero here, so it's finally feeling like Alaska. Oh. It's cold and clear, and snow is coming later in the week, so it's Alaska, man.
Zero? You mean the same latitude as Edinburgh and Northern Ireland? You're getting zero?
Well, no, zero Fahrenheit degrees, Dave. But
that's freezing, yeah.
No, it is freezing. We're getting down to zero Fahrenheit.
Oh, yeah. That's cold?
That's cold,
that's
yeah.
Arctic blast. Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
I was under the impression that the Pacific Ocean moderates the temperatures of the coastline on southeast Alaska.
Well, it usually does. Typically here in Ketchikan, we are warmer than places farther north, and Juneau gets freezing weather much more than we do. But it's freezing here now, so I got to have the heat tape on and have a little trickle of water going.
Heat tape on your pipes.
Yes, sir.
So is this unseasonably cold, or do you get this every few years,
yeah.
Okay, cool. In the mornings, I'm scraping frost off my truck here in Ojai, California, an hour and a half north of Los Angeles. So that's pretty chilly for this area. But then it'll heat up to 70 degrees during the day.
Yeah, tough times, man. Tough times. Yeah, here we are.
And you know what they say about people who talk about the weather?
They're dull and boring, and that's all they could talk about. So here we are.
That's right. They have nothing else to talk about.
We got lots to talk about.
Yeah, which is quite the opposite, because we have an amazing guest today.
Oh, man, I am so...
Well, he's right up your
alley. I am so excited, Dave. It's just crazy. I'm nervous Nelly. I'm just like, oh, he's one of my lifelong art heroes.
Well, you know, I have to be honest, I didn't know of him until you suggested we interview this amazing man. Explain what his name is, who he is, and why you were nervous now.
Well, Jay Maternus is his name, and you are familiar with his work because you've seen it over the years.
Oh, yes, that is true, but I didn't connect the dots.
And that's kind of one of the problems is that people don't know about Jay because he's remained kind of anonymous. You have to look in the credits, you know, in the back of the Time Life books that as a kid... Yeah. I had these Time Life books, and there were these murals, the ages of mammals, that just blew me away, and the detail in them, and just all the light in these paintings, and they're just full of creatures, and that was Jay's work, and I didn't really come to realize later, you know, in life, that who that artist was, and began to recognize his work elsewhere in all these Time Life books, and then, of course, all the fantastic Smithsonian murals, so.
And what's great about his murals is he'll paint an entire ecosystem, so all the animals will be in the scene. Obviously, not, you know, in real life, they would not all be in the same scene because they'd be eating each other.
Yeah.
But you go down and you can see the incredible details.
There's so many.
We'll dive into
so many details. Just get lost. Not only the fauna, but the flora. So the entire ecosystem is there. Carefully researched it. He did his animal studies. And he's just an iconic guy in terms of the art that he made. And just this. And it's a fantastic career that he's had. And I'm so excited that our friend Kirk Johnson has gone to pick him up and brought him to his office.
Well, I was just going to say that we have to give very special thanks to Kirk because how old is Jay?
Jay is 89, approaching 90. So
right. And so Kirk actually has driven to his house on a Sunday, picked him up, and brought him back to his office at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural, the National Museum. What is it called again?
I think we call this
National Museum of Natural History.
Yeah, something like that. It's a lot.
Yeah. And so we're going to be interviewing both of them in the office, and hopefully Kirk will be able to chime in because he's always wonderful to listen.
Yeah, this is just so cool, Dave. Like I said, I'm nervous, but I've met Jay a few times now. Kirk and I actually went over to his house, I think in 2014, and went down into Jay's studio, which is in his basement. And just there's so much art there. It was just very cool. Blew me away. So.
Well, we'll have as much as we can on his episode of Paleonerds on the Jay Maternus website page. It'll be pretty amazing. And I found something I want to ask him about, which is quite unlike anything he's drawn.
Okay, so, an outlier, huh?
Yeah, it's a surprise. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, all right. This is going to be so fun, man. Shall we call him up?
Sure.
Do it on the old rotary, traditional style.
Okay, yeah, all right, because he's almost 90 years old. I'll do it on the rotary.
Good. Yeah.
Here we go. All right.
Hey, Dave, meet Jay Maternus, paleo artist, anatomist, muralist, and illustrator extraordinaire, and I'm proud to say one of my friends. So, Jay, it's really good to see you.
Well, it's nice to be here and to be interviewed.
Well, it's an honor to meet you. And of course, in the other room is Kirk Johnson, who is, it's not just the three of us, Ray. There's an interloper.
Also known as Jay Maternus's chauffeur.
Oh, that's right. Thank you. Thank you for picking him up on this Sunday morning. Jay, are you a paleo nerd?
I'm not sure I understand what a paleo nerd is. A definition, please.
Well, no, let's have Dr. Johnson. Yeah, you came up with this phrase. Yeah, you came up with it, Kirk.
Okay, so Jay, Ray and I traveled around the American West meeting people, and mm-hmm. we slowly came to realize that every once in a while you'd bump into somebody who had a very strong interest in fossils. And we started calling these people paleo nerds, and we found that they were often one or two per town, so we called them isolated paleo nerds or isolated paleo nerd syndrome or IPNS. Yes. Both Ray and I suffer from IPNS, isolated paleo nerd syndrome. And yes. Dave Strassman's kind of curious if you too might be an isolated paleo nerd.
I would guess you could say that I am, but I'm mostly in terms of finished fossils rather than field work. I've never done any field collecting of fossils.
Well, I guess the definition really would be those people that are passionate about prehistoric things and or dinosaurs and that kind of thing.
Well, in that sense, yes. I would guess that would be universal, actually.
Okay. Yeah, you are a paleo nerd, Jay. Okay, we established that.
Thanks for the definition.
Well, Jay, I just want to start out that, you know, like I said, it's such an honor to have you here. And I grew up looking at a lot of your artwork over the many years. You and I share kind of similar origin stories. I'm an Air Force brat, and you're an Army brat.
That's right.
And yes. We've actually been kind of in some of the same places in the world. But what's your origin story? You were born in the Philippines.
Yes, I was. My dad was an Army surgeon. And so we were stationed in a number of different places in the world, including in Panama at the time that Pearl Harbor was attacked. Mm. I've lived all over, spent the war years in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And then, of course, after that, we were stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington.
You're one of those kids, like in high school and early on in elementary school, you were always drawing animals, right? And in high
That's
school,
correct.
You were
yes.
drawing creatures. Where did that passion come from?
Well, I'm not sure. I've never really questioned where it might have come from. It just seemed to be natural.
What was the animal that you drew a lot when you were a kid? I drew elephants because I visited the tar pits at La Brea, and I loved mastodons and mammoths. Mm-hmm. What was your favorite animal that you started drawing at an early age?
Well, I've had a natural proclivity for primates, and I've often wondered whether or not it was a result of the fact that in the Philippines, my father had two monkeys as pets.
Really?
And when I was a little toddler, I may have been exposed to this, but most of my drawings that I was making from memory of the animals that I'd observed in the zoos, including a lot of details.
You had a life-changing visit to the Museum of Natural History in 1946 and to the Bronx.
That's Zoo. Correct, yes.
And I know that that really imprinted on you. And so Kirk and I often joke about, we've often talked about our childhood superpower. Mm-hmm. Mine was drawing as well, and it sounds like drawing was your thing. So you were usually in a lot of your high school classes, and then you were drawing animals instead of paying attention to your teachers.
Instead of making French declensions in study hall, I was doing animal drawings.
Yeah. Well, tell us about that visit to New York City in 1946, because I know that your friend Richard Milner has mentioned it, that it was very life-changing, kind of helped set you on your course.
Absolutely. Well, my father was at Columbia University at that time, and he said to my mother, he said, why don't you send Jay up over the weekend, and we can view the Bronx Zoo and the American Museum of Natural History, which I did. And that's something I just never forgot. It really did set the whole course of my life. Mm. Because at that particular point, my father really hadn't taken it seriously. He thought, you know, the boy was simply amusing himself with animal drawings. He had in mind that I would follow him as an MD. Mm. And
my dad was the same way. He wanted me to be a doctor. And I said, no way am I doing an extra 8 years of school.
But it wasn't until I had met a portrait artist in Philadelphia. My father asked him, he said, does this boy, my son, does he have enough talent to make it as an artist? Hmm. His conception of an honorable profession was either the law or medicine. Hmm. And that's what he had in mind for me. But he couldn't really conceive of somebody making a life work as an artist. So Justin Pardee, the portrait artist in question, said, yes, he has the talent, but that isn't the thing that causes one to succeed in this field or any other. It has to do with persistence and drive.
Right.
And that you must take the setbacks and keep on trying.
That's great advice.
It was, yes.
So you really had your drawing chops down. You really, you enjoyed drawing and painting, I presume, too, at that point?
Yes, I was doing a painting as well, yes.
But yet there was this bond with the animals, and there was a neighbor lady also who was pivotal in your life.
Yes, that was a lady who taught French at a private girls' school in Pittsburgh, and she saw some of my drawings, and she got the idea to take those drawings to the chief staff artist at the Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh, and he in turn took those drawings and showed them to the director, Wallace Richards.
Wow.
At that time, and Wallace Richards was one of Richard King Mellon Foundation men. And he took those drawings to the committee, and they offered me a full scholarship to Carnegie Wow. Institute of Technology, which is now Carnegie Mellon University, with the idea that I would be working part-time during the school year and full-time during the summer recesses, which is what I did. And it worked out very nicely for me.
That's brilliant. What was your first assignment?
I think it was a series of paintings of the life cycle of raccoons, if I can remember correctly, because the emphasis was largely on local fauna. And in my spare time, I would go out to the Highland Park Zoo in Pittsburgh and continue my sketching of animals as I had done for the Philadelphia Zoo when we were living in Philadelphia. That was 1950.
I also read, too, when you were at Carnegie Tech, Jay, you were working at the museum and you're studying. You were also started participating in animal dissections with local zoo animals, or was
not at that time. No, that was done later when I went to the Cleveland Museum of Natural History, and I was working as their staff artist. And when the Cleveland Zoo would lose an animal or a bird that they wanted that the museum wanted for the collections, I would oftentimes accompany the curator of collections to go out and skin the animal. This was at City Hospital in the pathology labs. I would skin the animal and grab as much information as I possibly could. The first animal that I worked on was a female Indian antelope, a Nilgai.
Wow.
And subsequently, and one that was a great joy to me, was a huge male mandrill that had escaped from its cage in the Cleveland Zoo and was such a formidable animal.
That's
that,
a primate.
The police had to shoot it.
Oh, dear.
It was a beautiful, beautiful animal.
Is that the primate with the big blue stripes?
Oh, yes.
Yes. Yeah.
A red line right down the nasal area, a flared nostrils with and a nice saffron yellow goatee, and his face is framed with saffron yellow hair. It's a very striking animal.
Did you take notes and do drawings as you pulled skin and muscle?
I made a drawing because we were working against time, because the animal had to be skinned out quickly, because the museum wanted not only his skeleton, but they wanted his pelt for a mount that was subsequently made. That requires that you not tarry.
Yeah.
It has to be skinned out and salted down, prepared for the taxidermy. And subsequently, it was mounted into a very nice mount in the museum.
And what does barbecued mandrel taste like? Just kidding.
I wouldn't know.
Well, Jay, one of your quotes in research and getting ready for this interview is, you've said, in order to interpret the past, one has to have a working knowledge of the present. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward. But I think that experience of dissecting animals and having access to a zoo and then a museum, that really, you're doing things that many, many paleo artists just only dream of. And you were able to have that working, literally deep knowledge of animals and mammals in particular, it seems like.
Yes, mostly mammals, yes.
But that's what gave you the ability to really reconstruct ancient animals, because you had an understanding of their descendants or relatives, right?
You can infer from the skeleton of an extinct animal what you know from your direct hands-on experience with extant animals. And I continued that practice when I came here to the Smithsonian while I was doing my mural work and others, when a zoo animal became available to me. The museum was very, very accommodating. They allowed me to store the animal in the freezer in the specimen preparation lab, and then to thaw it and to gross dissect the animal when I had the leisure time to do it. And that would not have been possible if I had not been working at a museum of natural history.
Well, we happen to have a museum director right here with us today, and who's written a whole book about, that's maybe a nice segue to talking about the mural project, the Smithsonian. Doctor?
You know, this is the thing. When I got to the museum, I encountered these beautiful giant murals that Jay had done between 1960 and 1974.
Yes.
And we were renovating the hall, and we were taking the murals down. And these murals were some of my favorite murals of prehistory. They're incredible because you can view them from a distance and you hear this huge scene, or you can get up really close and the detail is there right up until you put your nose against the painting. And it was traumatizing to me to have to remove the murals to make way for the new exhibit. So I first of all, I made sure the murals were carefully rolled and archivally stored. Second, I tracked down Jay and found out Jay was living not too far from the museum and struck up a friendship with Jay. And then third, I said, you know, we should make these murals into a book, because many of them have been published before, but in small format. And we wanted to publish them in a format that they would be really available. And I can remember when after I met Jay the first time, I took Ray out to visit him, and we went into Jay's basement and found all the pencil drawings.
It was mind-blowing.
Wow.
It was mind-blowing.
But you digitized them, right? Didn't you digitize them prior to removal from the museum?
Well, the murals themselves, yeah.
Yeah, the murals themselves.
We had big cameras on tracks and did a really high-resolution digitization, but the discovery of this trove of pencil drawings in Jay's basement, I was like, this has got to be a book, because these murals are amazing, but the each individual drawing, and there were hundreds of these drawings, of studies of animals or parts of animals or groups of animals. Mind-boggling. Ray was there. He was blown off his feet.
I remember that day very clearly. I took a few photos along the way, but it was such a thrill to go to your house and meet you, Jay, and then to go down into the basement. And I really first became aware of you like through the Time Life books, and these were featuring.
Oh, yes. Me too.
North America.
North America.
Okay, I still have the copy that my mother got for our family, and then it was followed up by Early Man,
Time Life books. One on South America as well.
And South America. And the murals of the Ages of Mammals, those were the Smithsonian murals. And I was putting all this together and then realizing you were kind of anonymous in a way because your name was not really associated with these magnificent murals. And I have to look in the back to find out who you were. And to finally meet you and put the face to the art was so thrilling. But how did those murals come to be in the first place? It's about 1960 when you did your first mural. And you did them more or less in order, right? The big one.
The first one was the Eocene, simply because of the layout of the hall. The Miocene, and then the Oligocene and the Pliocene murals were set in alcoves. The halls could be opened and the public flowing through, and I would still be at work behind a barricade on the murals itself.
But you were working during opening museum hours?
Oh, yes. And, and into the night as well.
But hidden by a wall?
Yes. to keep me insulated from the public. It was interesting, though, you could monitor the comments, the offhand comments of many members of the public. I remember in one occasion when I was doing the Oligocene mural, across the hall from that was a beautiful slab donated by the Shell Oil Company, I believe it was. It was called the Strawberry Slab, which showed the footprints of a fossil mammals of the Oligocene, footprints in the mud, which had solidified, of course, into stone. And apparently there was a boy and a girl, a boyfriend and girlfriend situation, and they were standing in front of that, and I could hear this. I couldn't see them, I could just hear them. She said, "What is that?" And he explained to her that these were dinosaur prints. He concocted the most incredible
line of BS, perhaps. Yes, okay.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And there was a very neat caption right there. They would have explained everything that they needed to know about this. And I wondered to myself, you know, what are we doing here? What am I about? What's the value of something if people don't really read the labels and inform themselves of what they're looking at?
Did you step out from behind the wall and say, "You've got that all wrong, buddy"?
I was tempted to do that.
Oh, see, now I would have done that.
Kirk, I think that your administration of the museums that I've visited, that you've been part of, you've helped change that ancient way of display and a boring description into a more of an immersive and in-your-face experience.
Certainly, there's been more of a focus on audience and how people might react to things and what they're interested in. But it is fascinating because people come into the museum off the streets with sometimes no knowledge at all about prehistory. And so you can't expect them to sort of take on board the entire history of the planet just from one stroll in a museum. And that's kind of the whole point of the museum, is it's for everybody, whether you have a lot of knowledge and interest or whether you have none at all. And it sounds like that date was the guy was just scrambling to stay ahead of his girlfriend a little bit there.
Well, I want to ask you, you know, I've painted a few murals in my day, Jay.
Quite a few, as a matter of fact, yes.
Not on the scale that you have. And just so the audience understands this, each of these murals, and there's six of them.
How big?
Roughly 12 by 20 feet tall. 12 feet tall and about 20 feet long.
That's massive.
On average, yes. But they did vary in length, yes.
And each one took you about a year to paint. And that's not really even counting the prep time and all that.
No,
and you worked
no.
crazy long hours. And it's a physical task to get up on a ladder. Were these paintings, the canvas was adhered to the wall, right? So you're working standing up.
By a very skilled craftsman here in the museum's preparation labs. He knew exactly how to mount those canvases, which were 1-piece Belgian linen canvases.
Wow.
mounted to a plaster wall. And at that time, it was very difficult to find craftsmen who could make an actual plaster wall, because at that time, everything was wallboard.
Right.
So,
but couldn't you just get an old sail from a square rigger?
No. These were built in under canvases.
So they were glued to the wall.
They were. Yes, they were.
Okay.
He used a combination of Elmer's glue, white glue, and a retarder. And he was able to mount those canvases in one afternoon.
Wow.
On the scale, he had a system of trees, vertical supports to either side with notches. And he would put the adhesive first to the wall. Then he would press all that with a smoothing brush. And then he would lower the next section, and he'd go all the way down to the bottom. And the next day, the canvas would have developed air bubbles, which I was astonished and very much concerned about. He said, right. No matter. So he took a big hypodermic, and with the glue, he re-injected it through the canvas and smoothed it down on the wall. So we had a perfect working surface. And then he followed that with at least six coats of white acrylic gesso. And that was
And the process was, you had done a small painting, right?
Yes,
a preparatory painting.
Yes.
And that had to be approved by all the scientists,
it did,
right?
Yes, yes.
And what was that process like? Can you tell us, have any anecdotes there?
Well, first of all, of course, I had to reconstruct all of the members of the
fauna.
Yes. Right. And I worked with Louis Gayson. He was the curator at that time. And we discussed together. We worked very closely with each other. I might say parenthetically that working with a curator is one of the fun parts of doing something like this. I really enjoyed all of the people I worked with. It was a very, very wonderful experience.
What was the not so fun part?
Well, and the actual doing of it.
Right.
That becomes work.
Which leads me to ask you, when you walk in that very first day and there you have a massive blank white canvas,
yes,
and you obviously in your left hand you have the drawing of what you're going to do, the sketch or the rest.
Yes, my preliminary sketch.
What's the very first thing that you draw? Do you do the background? Is it
do
you sketch out the animals?
Is to make a grid. You snap a cord with charcoal, and you have a nice grid, which you have also on your preliminary sketch. And you use that to enlarge the design in charcoal.
Ooh.
Subsequently, you remove the grid, of course, and then you make changes on the wall as required, because a small sketch does not give you exactly the same proportions, the relationships within the mural, as the actual large mural itself. So it was a matter of making that
change. So there's a bit of improvisation as you paint.
Yes, to some extent.
And this is with oils, correct? So you have...
No, these were acrylics.
Oh, so they dry straight away.
Oil paint gives too much of a sheen. In a museum exhibition hall where you have no control over reflections of lights from other exhibits. So that was the whole reason. And I like very much to work with acrylics because they dry very quickly.
Yeah, I agree. That's why I like them too. Yeah,
but you can paint over them if you want to change something.
Oh yes,
right? Yeah, right.
Yes, as a matter of fact, they are more amenable to changes and overpainting than oil would be.
Which takes so long to dry.
Well, not only that, but the thing is, if you get too much of a buildup of oil paint, you can develop cracks.
Right.
Particularly with changes in barometric pressure and humidity and such.
What I find so stunning about the murals is not only the amount of detail, Jay, and the careful research that's gone into depicting these animals as accurately as it can. They've become these icons, too, of like you were the first one to figure out some of these animals and to portray them. But there's an incredible sense of light and atmosphere in these paintings, and they're so detailed. There's like a time of day that you have captured, and the atmosphere, it's hard to convey. Did you have, as an artist, a vision of
the time of day, we want to do an autumn thing or have a shift, that you knew that these murals were all going to relate to each other.
Yes, exactly.
Talking about the atmospherics.
I tried to keep the local weather conditions and the light varied between all four of the murals in the Fossil Mammal Hall. Same is true of the two that I did in the Ice Age Hall. Yes, they would all be consistent in terms of your eye level, your viewing level, but they would be varied so that you would get a different sense of day and of lighting in the various murals.
Well, one of my favorite, I guess this wasn't a mural, but when you mentioned atmosphere, you painted a lions attacking a Cape buffalo, and in the background is a storm roll cloud.
Yes, a roll cloud, yes.
And that's such a rare atmospheric phenomenon, maybe not in the Midwest, during the tornado season, but what an interesting choice.
I was looking for something that would be dramatic to reflect the drama in the foreground. That roll cloud, of course, would bring a fast-moving weather front that would have brought intense rainfall. That particular scene would have been a mud flat in just a few minutes after the action that I was depicting. But I want to say one thing about the murals.
Yeah.
With all of the animals that I had to depict, I could not show a literal visitor's level eye level.
Right.
I had to assume that the eye level was very high so that all of these animals could be included and depicted close enough to the viewer to give significant sense of the animal.
So as though you were 20 feet in the air?
No, just that you were fairly small and looking upward at the mural. And that particular thing had to be carried through to all four of those murals.
That's really incredible. And the sheer scale of it and it's fascinating, all the little details in it. And I remember too, when I was lucky enough to visit your house and your studio, you did these murals over like a 15-year process, and you're like 27 years old, I think, when you first started.
Yes.
Yeah, so this is a big part of your life. But these murals happened, and there was some politicking too to help get them at the end. And you mentioned something about Spiro Agnew. Do you remember
Nixon's
this story?
Vice president?
Oh, well.
Yes, I'm just going time traveling back, and I remember this little anecdote about, but I wasn't clear what it was. What was
that,
Jay?
Late 60s, early 70s.
70s.
Well, this happened without my knowledge. I learned about it later, but one of the people who was director of exhibits at that time apparently had proposed that the murals be photographed and produced as the preliminary sketch made into a photo mural. And saving on the expenditure.
I see. Didn't need that muralist.
And as a matter of fact, several people, as I say, unknown to me, had gone up to the Hill and had solicited both Teddy Kennedy in the Senate and Spiro Agnew. Huh. And apparently some...
Bipartisan.
Yes, some of it came down to... the administration. I never knew all of the details. This, as I say, I learned about it only much later. And apparently permission was given for the final mural. It was the Alaskan mural that was in question.
Yeah, I think that's what I remember, because that's what I saw in your basement that day was the painting, the study for that.
Yes.
I thought it was a poster at first. You had painted it in such detail, but like, oh my God, that's the famous Alaska mammoth step painting.
That's brilliant that politics actually was in favor of art.
Paleo art, no less.
Yeah, paleo art.
But one of the things, too, that you did with these murals is you made trips to the locations where the murals were set,
yes.
If that was relevant. You traveled to Alaska
and
you traveled to Idaho.
Dale Guthrie quite well.
And then Bill Berry, too.
Yes, Bill Berry was...
Sorry, who is Dale and Bill?
Dale Guthrie was at that time a professor at the University of Alaska, and he was the one who took me out onto the tundra to make studies for the eventual mural. We carried a camera, and we had a rifle and a lot of mosquito repellent, because those mosquitoes were, they are phenomenal, I must say.
Clouds of
Yes. At the time that we were there, the caribou were migrating, and at that time they're also shedding. So their large patches of their skin are exposed to these horrendous mosquito attacks. But fortunately for the caribou, snow patches, which may be present, because this was during the spring and summer, they can stand on a snow patch, and for some reason or other, mosquitoes didn't swarm at them on that patch.
That's interesting.
And then Bill Berry was an artist up at Fairbanks, too, that he's a wonderful artist.
And Bill Berry's work is just phenomenal. He's one of the greatest animal artists extant. He's one of my all-time favorites.
And he worked for Disney, and I see a lot of similarities in the way he drew uh-huh. animals and you. But
he was a field naturalist.
Yes.
He went out into the field, and he would make studies of these animals in the field from observation through binoculars or just through close-up sometimes. One of his favorite animals was the moose, and no one has never done moose with greater sympathy than Bill Berry.
Hey, I have a question. I don't know if you can see behind me. There's a beautiful mural that Uh-oh. Ray painted. It's called Sabretooth Everything. Uh-huh. And he painted a giant saber-tooth salmon, and he has great shame because he painted the tusks Uh-oh. Slightly incorrect. And they found through later discovery in fossils that the tusks actually are almost horizontal rather than down. Is there any portion of your murals that were pointed out at a later date where they went, we don't think it looks like that? Obviously, you were limited in what fossils and discoveries at the time, but is there anything that was pointed out later on?
Yes, there was a gentleman who was here at the Smithsonian for a short time, and then he went on to Harvard. His name was Hickey, Dwayne Hickey, and he took exception to my interpretation of the terrain of the Miocene mural, the early Miocene. He said that there would have been less grasses, fewer grasses, or less expanses of grasses, and more shrubs together with copses of trees than I had shown. I think that was a legitimate criticism. If I had a chance to do it over again, I would make those changes, and a lot of things that I would have changed. For example, I pointed out that the grasses in the Miocene mural, which is lower Miocene, lacked inflorescence. I would attend to that now in a way I was not really particularly aware of at the time that I painted it.
But these are also discoveries that you would not have known about.
Yeah, this is the thing. Leo Hickey was actually my PhD advisor, and the field of paleobotany was kind of in a rough spot in the 60s, and we got a lot more information started coming out in the 70s. So Leo was able to look at these murals and go, yeah, we know that that's not the scene because we have these new fossil sites, these new ways of interpreting the fossils themselves. So it, in a way, the animals are more accurate than the plants in some of those murals, or not the plants themselves, but the landscapes. But you corresponded with a lot of paleobotanists and invertebrate paleontologists. I mean, that's what's so amazing to me is every one of those animals that's painted, there's a whole series of drawings of the skeleton and the muscled out animal and the different postures. And you seem to be obsessed with feet. many of the animals, you can see the footprints. And I'm wondering if that marked back to your love of footprints, but almost every one of your paintings, if you look, you can spot one upturned foot, so you can actually see all the details of the feet of these animals.
Well, the feet are extremely important in revealing the lifestyle of the animal, and two things that are quite diagnostic of any fossil are teeth and the structure of the feet. So I felt obliged to show the feet in all of the representations I made of them. You know, you ask about other changes that I would have made. It was not so much to the murals as to an illustration I did for National Geographic, a book of the animals of East Africa by Louis leaking.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the animals he wanted to have reconstructed was a very large suid that he called Afrocurus.
What is that?
Well, it's a big pig. It's larger than the giant forest hog of today.
Mm.
And it had formidable tusks came out of the upper jaw. And I was making preliminary sketches of the reconstruction of this animal, which were to be shown to Louis Leakey to get his approval before it could be published. And he asked me to make the tusks running straight forward. And I knew it to be wrong.
Mm.
There's no way that animal could have gotten food into its mouth with large tusks projecting forward. But because Louis Leakey was such a formidable political person, and I would have run some interference with the top brass at National Geographic at that time, I made the concession, even though I knew it was wrong. And I've always regretted that. Because at an earlier time, when I was younger and more brash, I took exception with a criticism that was made by Remington Kellogg, who was a formidable scientist. He wanted me to show the large animal called Uintatherium in the Eocene mural.
Right. The giant mammal.
Yes, as the way it was mounted in for the hall, had a beautiful skeleton. But it was mounted with the elbows sticking outward in the same mode as many Permo-Triassic reptiles from the Karoo. And
Cynodonts.
I took exception to it. I said, I know, Dr. Kellogg, that animal was large enough. It would have required him to place his legs straight, not bent elbow. He wasn't doing push-ups. He conceded the point. He said, Maternus, he said, it would have been far easier for you to make that reconstruction as it's shown than for us to remount that skeleton. So, I won the point at that time.
That's good.
But not the time with Louis Leakey. And I've always regretted that business with Louis Leakey, particularly since that is something that was published and there are hundreds of images of that. I would just as soon tear that page out of the book.
But that's sacrificing your integrity as an artist, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, as a scientist, actually, really, too. You know, because you're a scientist as well, really, in your reconstructions. And you go through this very methodical process that few paleo artists or artists do in reconstructing the past, especially you start with the bones, number one, the structure of the bones. You know how the bones fit together. Then you lay the muscles over them because of your knowledge of dissection, and then you add the skin, and then you add or the covering, the fur, or whatever, and then the coloration based on existing animals and your own research.
Yes.
But once you've gone through that process, Jay, there's got to be kind of a magical moment in that, and I've tried to describe this because I do a little bit of this, nowhere near what you do, but when you have a new fossil or an animal that's never been depicted before, you are the first one, really, because of your work, you're able to see this animal for the first time, like in all the world. You know what I'm saying? You've done the careful research. There's got to be a passion and a drive and just a curiosity to bring these animals back to life that you must be driven by.
Well, as a matter of fact, once I arrive at an actual covering of the animal, and I'm working with my curator all the time, getting his opinion and even other curators as well from other institutions in some cases. Then I start to make freehand drawings of the animal in various positions and attitudes. In other words, I move him around in space so that I know what that animal is like, how he would dispose himself, how he would sit down, how he would climb, all kinds of ideas. And once again, I run these past my curator.
A great example is the Jane Goodall's chimpanzee in the rain dance frenzy. You have these chimpanzees in all these different positions and movements. And it's a great illustration of exactly what you're talking about, which we'll have on your page at Paleo Nerds. But I do have a question regarding anatomy. I found a drawing you did on your website, which is j-maternus.com. You painted a Roman soldier from Herculaneum, which, as we know, is the sister city to Pompeii, mm-hmm. that was destroyed, yes. by Vesuvius in 79 AD. This drawing seems to be a test work in progress, as the soldier's head was first depicted as a bare skull, then fleshed out with muscle, then a recognizable face. But what is striking in this sketch is that he had what looked like a healed compound fracture in his femur.
Yes, so exactly.
What is the story behind the drawing of this Herculaneum soldier with the broken upper leg bone? Painful.
Well, yes, it's interesting because that particular illustration, I was working with Sarah Beisel, who had been doing the reconstructions at Herculaneum. She had provided this particular bit of information, but apparently there was a mix-up in the femurs. There was a left femur that showed a compound fracture that had healed with a bit of callus, making a rather large lump spur. In the...
It's a big spur in it.
Yes, but that somehow got... And I did the illustration on that basis, but subsequently it was discovered that I had been shown the wrong femur.
Oh.
So I had to redo the position of the legs from a finished illustration in the proper position.
Is there a story behind the skeleton?
Yes, it was interpreted as a soldier as a result of the artifacts that were found with him. The sword and the general physique of the man shows that, sure. he was a fairly substantial chap.
Well, we'll have that picture on the website. It's quite striking. I'm sorry, the drawing. Yes. We'll have the drawing on the website.
Such a wide span of your work, Jay. But kind of back to some of the paleo obsession of bringing creatures back to life. You spent about 11 years working on Ardipithecus.
Yes.
And you had to do that in secrecy, basically, for 11 long years.
Exactly, right.
Can you tell us a little bit about Ardipithecus? Because it was a huge... This is before Australopithecus, and maybe what, yes. why Ardipithecus is so significant.
Well, Australopithecus is the Lucy discovery that Leakey
right.
did,
that's
right?
Right. Yes. Yeah. I went to Kent State University to deal with Owen Lovejoy, the curator. He was one of the three people that I was using as my consultants. What I did while I was at Kent State University was to make detailed drawings of each of the elements that I was to reconstruct, including all of the existing bones of the hands and feet. It was an associated fossil. This is one of the things that is rare in doing a fossil reconstruction, where you have an individual which is represented by all of its elements. Well, there were missing elements in this one. For example, we did not have a humerus, the upper arm bone, on this particular animal. So I spent a lot of time making inferences from the published literature about the relative length of the arm of an animal that was partially arboreal and, well, we happen to know it was also terrestrial, which is most unusual among primates.
How old is Ardi in the hominin
I think the interpretation was about 4.5 million.
So they use tools?
Oh, no. At this time, there's no evidence for it.
Right, right.
We don't.
I believe tool use goes to about 3.1 million or something
like that.
You're close, Dave, but recent discoveries in Kenya show that the oldest stone tools date back to an astounding 3.3 million years. And no, it wasn't some old rusty screwdriver, but rather they were fist-sized chunks of chipped rock with sharp edges shaped into tools that were probably used for cutting meat or cracking nuts. And who were these early toolmakers? It may have been Australopithecus afarensis, but it's also possible these tools were made by a completely different hominin species well outside the human genus. What we do know is that this was the first known manufacturer of stone tools in the world, 3.3 million years ago. Pretty mind-blowing.
Wasn't the Denver Museum also a part of your history?
Yes, we were stationed at Fitzsimmons General Hospital near Aurora. And one of the things I asked my parents to do is to take me to the Denver Museum of Natural History at that time. It's now the Denver Museum of...
Nature and Science, yeah.
Nature and Science, yes.
Yeah.
And that was a big turn-on for me. And the wonderful dioramas, which are one of the features of that museum... And a very large paleo collection as well.
Yeah, that was before the American Museum then?
Oh, yes, yes. This was in the 1930s.
Okay.
And you know a little bit about that museum, don't you, Kirk?
Well, I spent 22 years there, so we share a love for those dioramas.
Yeah, exactly. And I've walked the halls of your collection room with Ray.
Well, maybe before I ask the one question I always ask is, Kirk, did you want to jump in with thoughts or questions?
Jay's range of subject matter goes far beyond paleo art. He's done a lot of historical paintings and nature paintings and things. And, you know, we go to his house, there's these amazing images come out. But I'm kind of curious, Jay, what has driven you? Like, what's your passion? Or do you meet scientists and they try and lure you into painting their particular thing? Or how do you what's been the thing that really is most interesting to you in terms of painting anything of any age?
Well, Kirk, it's whatever I'm working on at the time. Become completely immersed in the subject. I can't really say I have any favorites. Paleontology is probably the most interesting and most challenging at the same time, which is one of the reasons why this book that I'm working on with Richard Milner right now has been rather difficult, because it's the lifespan of my work has been in a number of different fields, and a publisher wants to have you featured as a particular, in a particular field.
For you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm all over the ship, really, with subject matter and involvement with it. So and that was one of the big challenges that Richard faced as an author, was to give some coherence to my life's work, which I had never really bothered with before this book became imminent.
I think that's one of the things that, you know, Matt Carano and I did this book called Visions of Lost Worlds, The Paleo Art of Jay Maternus. And we just focused on the 6 mammal murals and the 4 reptile paintings that Jay did. So it's really 10 paintings, but there's just a whole story there. But this new book, the complete oeuvre of Jay Maternus, it's such a broad topic. We really hope that book makes it into publication.
I sure do too, because, and like Jay, I guess I suffer from the same thing, well, suffer or delight in. I've been able to follow my interests and my passions, and they're kind of all over the board, but
yes,
we live a rich life, and we get to draw and paint images, and mine is certainly very different than yours, Jay.
Whoa. Ray, you are an astonishingly...
I'm not fishing for compliments, although I like to pun.
No,
but thank you for... But following your passions, you've had an incredible life. You had interactions with Louis Leakey, some of these giants in the field, with Jane Goodall and Diane Fossey in particular.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I sure hope that that book comes into being, because all of your work really does need to see the light of day. We ask this of all our guests, and Jay, if you could time travel, and assuming that that's possible, what epic epoch, what favorite paleo period, what awesome age would you want to go back to and actually see?
I would say a transition between the Paleocene and the Eocene.
Why is that?
Well, for one thing, you have this transmigration of animals from Asia, replacing those which were native mammalian forms here in North America. And many of them are extremely bizarre, very difficult to envision in terms of their life patterns. That's the thing that would have fascinated me most, too, the fact that Wyoming at that time was like Florida. It was neotropical. You get such things as fan palms, sabal palms in Wyoming.
Well, I've got to say that having your paintings of these periods too allows us to actually get a glimpse of those worlds, you know. And so it's interesting to hear you say that's the one you'd like to see.
Yeah, that's the thing that fired my imagination most. But then, of course, during the Miocene, you get all these changes occurring as well in particular lines. For example, a progression of forms in the same line, and the same is true of horses and of rhinos and camels.
Yeah.
That's very fascinating. Alta camelus, for example, was proportioned much more like a giraffe for purposes of feeding on low-hanging vegetation then you wouldn't guess it to be a camel. That's one of the reasons that I showed it in the Miocene mural with a reticulated pattern on the back, very much like a modern giraffe.
Well, okay.
The matter of fact, it's interesting because the giraffe, when you have it out in the open, you can see it quite well. But on one of my safaris in East Africa, my driver pointed out a giraffe to me, and I couldn't see them. They were in a copse of trees, yes, standing under with the dappled pattern. And, you know, when you encounter giraffes in the wild, at some distance, they will stand there and look at you. They're absolutely still. And I didn't see it until one of them, the tail switched. And all of a sudden, I saw it.
Wow.
He could see it. He was an African, and he could see things that, that you and I would miss entirely.
Yeah, they have invisibility cloaks.
I was astonished to see how well camouflaged those giraffes were.
Brilliant. Well, I'm going to ask my question. This has been a wonderful interview, and I'm honored to be part of this. As a distinguished and talented artist whose legacy will live forever in many museums, I'm humbled by the beauty and detail of your paintings, murals, drawings. But to those young artists, scientists, and researchers who are just starting out in their careers, what wisdom or advice can you share that you wished you'd have known when you first started your career?
Well, for somebody starting out his career today, the thing to do is to get into the electronics. It's a digital age, and things are produced today and in a digital form. I don't know that much about it. I have not gotten into digital art at all. It's alien to my approach. And I know that many illustrators who use digital methods to produce their final result, they make freehand sketches first. They still draw first.
Start with a pencil. Yeah.
Yes, because ideas are generated from a moving pencil, right, whatever medium you're using. But that would be the way to get into it today with the digital technology.
Well, you use a digital pen, don't you, Ray, on some of your stuff?
Kinda. I'm still all hybrid.
Right.
Still a pen and ink. But no, I think that there really is something, though, to the truth, to the materials. That, in other words, the materials that you're using really does, well, just dictates the look of the finished piece. So if you had done those murals in oil, there would have been a different just finished look to them.
Yes.
And I think so what you're working with kind of dictates it. But the digital world is scrambling all of that, and because it can mimic all those styles, you know, digitally. But
yes.
I still think the power of a tangible object, the power of standing in front of your actual murals.
With your brush strokes.
With the brush strokes and everything, which actually, since we do have Kirk here, what is the future of those original murals, if I can ask Dr. Johnson?
Yeah, no, we preserve those murals so they'll last for 100 years. And, you know, sort of my goal that they assume an exhibit posture at some point in the future. I'm not sure when that is, but they're preserved in an archival manner. So they'll be around for hundreds of years. They're really true treasures. And when we were taking them off the wall, there was a moment when we didn't realize they were on canvas. It looked like they were the wall itself. And that was actually... yes, trying to figure out how to saw them in part so I could put them back together again. And I was so delighted to realize they could actually just be peeled off the walls and conserved and rolled in these giant rolls. But yes, they're in our archives, and they're part of the Smithsonian's permanent collection, and they'll reappear someday in some form.
And they have been digitized at high resolution, right? And so there are, there are two of them in the hall right now.
Yeah, digital facsimiles of them.
Digital facsimiles at a super high resolution. Well, that's good to know. Jay, I am just overwhelmed being able to, you know, spend some more time with you here. I really appreciate you taking the time and having Dr. Johnson come pick you up in Fairfax, Virginia, and drive you to Washington, D.C., our nation's capital. And thank you so much for joining us. It's always a fun time talking to you, and I learn a lot every time I talk to you. So thank you so much.
Well, it's my pleasure, really. It's quite an adventure for me. I've never done a podcast before.
Well, it's been an honor, Jay, and your work is just phenomenal. And
well, thank you, David.
Inspired me to study anthropology as a high school student from the Time Life book.
Oh. Yeah, thanks for including the chauffeur.
We'll send you $5 for gas.
What a great day. What a great Sunday afternoon. Thank you so much, you guys.
Well, thank you. Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Great fun.
Well,
amazing. I'd never really known of his work until you brought up Let's Interview Jay. And then when you sent me all the stuff, which will be on his webpage on Paleo Nerds, it is absolutely mind-blowing. And it also is so familiar because it's something that I saw as a kid in the Time Life book.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I was tracking his work for all those years, not knowing who